Did you ever watch The West Wing?
Mm-hmm.
They did some interview with former presidents, a special on the show, and Bill Clinton said something like, what everybody who's worked in the White House will tell you is that it was the hardest thing they ever did, but it was the best thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, if people ask me, I mean, the line that sort of evolved in my head is, worst job I've ever had and the best thing I've ever did.
Welcome to the latest episode of Wisdom at Work, Philosophy Beyond the Ivory Tower, where I interview people who translate philosophy into successful careers outside the academy, to tell their stories, how they found their way through the wilderness and reinvented themselves, and distill the insights, the decisions, the strategies, the tips, and the secrets to their success. If you're new to the podcast, I would recommend checking out episode 0, where I go into the background, the rationale, and the goals of the podcast. If you're interested in what I like to call people's Batman Begins stories, how they became who they are professionally, how they got their big break, how they found their success. If you are an undergrad considering declaring a philosophy major, or a graduating senior with a philosophy major, wondering what the hell you're going to do. If you're a master's student in philosophy, if you are a PhD in philosophy, if you are an academic, maybe even a full professor, and are looking for some outside-the-box, unconventional ways to apply your career, whether that is as a hobby, as a side gig, or maybe even as a career transition, then I think you're going to find a lot of value in these interviews. My guest today is the first example of what I've been calling an agent, someone who works in academia, but is not quite of it. Andrew Light is one of the people I first thought of when I was putting this podcast together, in part because he is probably one of the greatest success stories of an academic who has not only broken through and, you know, established a professional identity outside the academy, but has done so to great effect. As you've probably already surmised from the intro blurb, Andrew worked in the Obama administration as a climate policy expert in the State Department. He worked under Secretary Kerry and Todd Stern, the special envoy on climate change, to, in short, negotiate the Paris Agreement. Andrew played a pivotal role in working with the India delegation. In a conversation, Andrew tells the story of how he created a parallel professional identity. First, by breaking into the think tank and policy community in Washington, D.C., and second, actually landing a job in the United States government. In the first part of our conversation, he gives a report on the state of climate policy in the Trump era, how he got involved in interdisciplinary work, and what he thinks philosophers can contribute to the policy arena. A brief word about this conversation. So we actually recorded this 2 years ago, almost now. So some of the issues that Andrew discusses may be a little bit dated, but Andrew and I are actually going to record a follow-up episode later in the summer to give an update on where the national and international climate situation has gone in the last couple of years, as well as what we can expect from what will, at this point, most likely, it's looking to be an incoming Biden administration, and how some of the developments in the last 2 years, whether it is the Sunrise Movement, whether it is the Green New Deal, whether it is the increased prominence of environmental justice in climate circles, how all this is changing the overall political and cultural landscape with regard to climate. So stay tuned for that later in the summer. So a few announcements before I get to our guest for today. First of all, a shout out to Justin Weinberg at the Daily News for posting about the podcast and spreading the word. For those of you who don't know the Daily News, it is the go-to place for news in and around the profession of philosophy. So thanks again to Justin. Second, I'm thrilled to announce that Wisdom at Work is officially a member of Lyceum. Lyceum is a new app whose hand curation cuts through the noise of a million podcasts to help people find great educational shows and have great conversations about them right in the app. Download the app at lyceum.fm and then check out Wisdom at Work's discussion room to hang out with me and other listeners. Third, I am very excited to announce that Wisdom at Work has been awarded a grant from the APA, the American Philosophical Association, through the Barry Fund for Public Philosophy. I'm very grateful for their support. Without further ado, please enjoy my discussion with Andrew Light.
Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, David.
So my first question, and I think this is appropriate since we're speaking early in the morning. My first question after doing research on you for our interview was, do you ever sleep?
Well, I do now. I have to say the 3 years I worked in the Obama administration, I probably didn't sleep very much at all. And I often had to get up in the middle of the night to make calls to New Delhi to speak to our embassy there.
Uh-huh.
But yes, I sleep. I sleep. I try to sleep. You know, I am busy. But I think there are very few good consequences of what's happened with the last election in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
But one is that a lot of us alums from the who were doing climate and energy work for the Obama administration, and we were put to the test and had a lot of work to do for really good reasons, because we had a president and secretary of state and EPA administrator and everyone else who wanted to get a lot done.
Mm-hmm.
We are taking this as a chance to recharge a little bit, so hopefully we can jump back in there in 2020 again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard, this sort of reminds me, I did you ever watch The West Wing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
They did some interview with former presidents, a special on the show, and Bill Clinton said something like, what everybody who's worked in the White House will tell you is that it was the hardest thing they ever did. It was so horrible, but it was the best thing.
Yeah.
That it wreaked havoc on their health and personal life, but
yes. Yes.
But it was, you know, so worth it.
If people ask me, the line that sort of evolved in my head is, it was the worst job I've ever had and the best thing I've ever did.
there you go.
Yeah, it was just like, it was relentless. You're always on call, and there are kind of moments that you just kind of can't imagine that you can get to the next day, but you know, it was completely worth it to be able. It could be not worth it if you were in a position, if you're a career civil servant in a position, as unfortunately a lot of people are right now, where they're having to actively work to roll back things that they tried to achieve. But I think for political appointees who obviously don't take the jobs unless they believe in the people they're working for and the overall mission, it's relentless. It's
mm-hmm.
drinking fire hose. But at the end of the day, there's kind of no substitute for the amount of things that you can get done on issues you care about.
So we'll be getting into your work with the Obama administration and your ongoing work on climate policy later. Where are we speaking to you from?
I'm on vacation on Fire Island, which is off the southern shore of Long Island. I've been coming here for about 27 years now,
mm-hmm.
or so. One of my best friends, who is also an environmental ethicist, has a house here.
Mm-hmm.
So this is my annual couple weeks getting away with my family.
Got it. Well, again, as I told you when we were talking earlier, I feel guilty now that you're speaking on vacation. But you currently reside in Washington, D.C., right?
That's right. Yeah, I live
yeah.
in Washington.
Yeah. Whenever I see people from D.C. over the last year and a half, I sort of feel compelled to – I feel like I'm speaking with people who are living under occupied territory, and I think this has probably greater significance given what you do. When we saw each other last in Boulder at the Public Philosophy Network, one of the first things I asked you was, how goes the battle? And your answer was surprising, so let me ask you again, how goes the battle?
Really well. Really well. So if you look at what's going on in the United States on climate change and clean energy, which is sort of the issues that I've been working the most on for the last 15 or more years, you know, we obviously hit a high watermark with the Obama administration with respect to executive authority, with respect to actually using the office of the offices of the combined offices of the federal government, the White House, the president's authority to move forward on things. We didn't have Congress with us. That was a problem, and continues to be a problem today. But if you look at the, you know, the President's Clean Power Plan, the Climate Action Plan, the work that we did in creating the Paris Agreement, the work we did in creating what's called the Kigali Amendment to the Montreal Protocol, which is a global agreement to phase out hydrofluorocarbons, which are the most potent greenhouse gas. We just accomplished an enormous amount. And clearly we have a president now who is, to say the least, not committed to any of those ideals and is allowing, you know, the people around him to roll back all of those regulations. There was actually some very bad news today about the EPA announcing that they were going to freeze the current mileage standards, transportation sector at 30 miles per gallon in 2020 for the next 6 years, whereas the plan was originally to raise those standards to 50, which they've done an enormous amount to help to reduce U.S. emissions and global emissions.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the response from states and cities and the private sector has just been absolutely tremendous. And it started, you know, we started talking about this actually the day after the election.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out that the 2016 election coincidentally landed, was just 2-3 days into the annual UN Climate Summit, which is a 2-week meeting that happens in December every year.
Right.
It was at a summit like that where we got the final agreement on the Paris Agreement. And so the climate talks were in Marrakesh, so 2-3 days into that, you know, have this announcement that Trump had been elected. And at the time, I mean, Trump was most well known for just kind of saying either completely irresponsible and false things like climate change is a hoax created by the Chinese to just sort of, you know, not being noncommittal. And this is where he is today. He will not say whether he believes in climate change. No White House can get him or anyone who works at the White House to say whether or not the president believes in climate change. I think he's probably never bothered to look into it at all. It's, you know, pulling out of the Paris Agreement, which we'll talk about later, has just become, you know, a reliable applause line that he can use at his rallies around the country. But the day after the election, on the ground in Marrakesh, people from the U.S. climate community were already armed with abundant talking points about all of the activity that happens in the United States that's led by states.
Mm-hmm.
And this grew and grew and grew and grew. And then there was a long protracted fight that I was deeply involved in between the inauguration and June 1st of last year, which is the day that Trump announced that he was going to pull out of the Paris Agreement. And the fight was over, like, you know, what could we do to, like, keep the president from doing this, from rolling back? But what we knew was, regardless of whether he stayed in the Paris Agreement, he had appointed an EPA administrator, who's now, as we know, gone, Scott Pruitt.
Finally,
hoisted on his own petard. But we had an administration across the board that was committed to rolling back everything. And even if the U.S. stayed in the agreement, they were not going to try to fulfill their pledge under Paris, which is called the technical term for that is NDC, or Nationally Determined Contribution. So that's the vehicle whereby each country makes a pledge under Paris. And the week after June 1st, you had Jerry Brown, governor of California, go to China and sit in the Great Hall of the People with President Xi Jinping and talk climate change and renewable energy and sign a new agreement between California and the Chinese.
And would it be correct to say that nothing like that has ever happened before?
Well, there's been cooperation, but I think it was just the fact that it was so – there's been cooperation between the Chinese national government and a few of the states. But there's never been this kind of concerted wholesale push, and also symbolically, you know, the Chinese kind of acknowledging that the center of power and the center of influence and the center of gravity for action on these issues is now not in the federal government in the U.S. any longer. It's in the states. So the think tank that I work part-time for, the World Resources Institute, now since I left the administration, World Resources Institute was part of an effort that was funded by Bloomberg Philanthropies to count up all this activity, to count up the states and the cities and the private sector entities who are committed to fulfilling the U.S. pledge under Paris, even with the federal government backpedaling and trying to throw up roadblocks left and right. You add that all up together, it's about over 2,000 entities, non-federal or subnational entities, or something it's called. You add those all up together, if they were their own country, they would be the third largest economy in the world.
Wow.
Be the U.S., total U.S., right? There's China, number two. Number three would be, let's just call it the Climate States of America. Right? Bad acronym, but given U.S. history, but That's one way of referring to the climate states of America, and it's about half of the U.S. population and about half of the U.S. economy, and it would be the third largest economy in the world. And so it used to be that, you know, for years I woke up, and whether I was in or outside of government, I felt like, okay, I got a president who understands this, who gets this, who wants to move forward. It's going to be a tough slog, but we can get there. And now I wake up every morning and I literally think to myself, you know, I'm working for 15 governors, and hundreds of mayors and thousands of CEOs who are committed to getting there.
Yeah,
it's more complicated to organize all those folks and to move them forward and get them towards a greater level of ambition. But the fact is, it's there. So it's actually there's tons of great work to be done. People come to me all the time. They kind of go, "Oh, you must be so depressed. You spent all the time working on Paris. It must be awful for you." And I go, "No, it's not."
Yeah.
I have not felt bad. There are some particular smaller programs that will fall under the radar and are not the big ticket issues that I worked on that I'm very distressed about. But when it comes to the bigger picture, we've got all these non-federal entities in the U.S. working to move forward, and not a single country has followed the U.S. down this ridiculous path of backing away from Europe.
Yeah.
A single country.
Yeah.
Rock solid.
So as with many issues, the perpetual tweet storm from the federal level masks the underlying reality, the underlying dynamics. I remember shortly before who I will call the president left office, he published an article called the Irreversible Momentum of Clean Energy. And it was about how globally it's sort of locked in, like this is going to happen. The long-term decarbonization of the economy, and that a sort of a tipping point had been reached whereby you had powerful business interests and leaders in the business community who were now on board with Paris, who were now on board with clean energy, at least to some extent. So that for me, that was something that was surprising in that, you know, one of the big constituents, the business community, or at least in a major part of it, now seemed on board, so that one of the big forces of resistance to movement on climate and clean energy was removed. And yet, with the Trump administration, we got an even stronger backlash, I think, than anybody expected. So, I mean, feel free
I think that's right. I think that's right. So, I mean, there's two points I would want to make there. One is that those kinds of assessments are correct. That is the global trend. And that's the global trend in part because of things like the domestic processes that have been unleashed across the world, to move in this direction. And those have been collected and organized and motivated and given a platform where we can understand whether or not countries are actually making those changes through something like the Paris Agreement. So there's a really interesting study that was done by the International Finance Corporation after the Paris Agreement was finalized. And Paris has, as opposed to the other climate agreements that came before, like the Copenhagen Accords, the Kyoto Protocol, has an enormous amount of buy-in.
Mm-hmm.
You had, before the gavel went down for the first negotiation session, the 2 weeks of formal negotiations in Paris, already had commitments from parties representing over 98% of global emissions to reduce emissions either by 2025 or 2030. Countries got to choose which was their target date. That's a huge amount of participation. Now, then the question is, once you got participation, it's ambition, getting parties to do more. The IFC did a study just of the commitments by developing countries alone. And those countries, in those commitments, there is a $10 trillion market in renewable energy that's been created.
Wow. Like,
for those countries to hit their commitments that they want to, by 2030, you've created a $10 trillion market for renewable energy. Of course the private sector is going to chase that market.
Yeah.
It's like, that's what they do. So it would be irresponsible for them not to. So that's the good news. The harder news on the other side is that, of course, you still have some very politically influential sectors of the market, mostly privately held fossil fuel companies, and their allies, which remain politically influential. But the worry that I think is actually bigger to me is that there also is the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. And This is a very interesting thing. It's getting a lot of play. I think the last, and this is this initiative that the Chinese have created to basically create this massive infrastructure project around the world, going sea lanes and across the land over through Russia and Poland and into Europe and into Africa, where they are going to basically create these new trading routes. And part of it is that they are committed to helping countries invest in infrastructure, building ports, building all the kinds of things you need to do with that, and building energy transmission lines and power plants. The initial look at a lot of this investment so far, so this is going to be, again, another, this is going to be $1 trillion worth of investment between now, over $1 trillion between now and the early 2020s. And there you look at some of the initial work there, some by people like Kevin Gallagher, nearby you at Boston University, and Kelly Gallagher at Tufts. Look at those initial investments, and a lot of them are brown. A lot of it, they're still, the Chinese have stopped building coal plants at home, but they're building coal plants in other countries.
Oh.
So, and this is distressing. And this is where, again, this is, I think, this is not unleashing market forces. This is, in part, I think, the preservation of a particular sector of the Chinese economy by exporting it overseas. The United States was standing up to China on this, or at least trying to. We were really, it was hard. There were four joint statements that were signed between President Obama and President Xi on climate cooperation, the most famous being November 2014, when we kind of shocked the world and announced our pledges for Paris a year before the conference happened, and that was helped to lead this kind of race to the top for countries to announce ambitious pledges like both the U.S. and China were. But at the same time, we then started pushing them, okay, it's not just about what you do with your own economy, it's what you do with respect to assistance overseas. And so the U.S. had led a big effort, first in the OECD, the World Bank, it's with other and other multilateral development banks to stop financing fossil fuels. And you know, we're pulling the world along with us and struggling with the Chinese on getting them to make an explicit commitment on that. Did and we backed off, and we were sort of in the middle of that. That was the, exactly the kind of effort that you would have wanted to continue, right? With the Clinton administration, and obviously it's not happening. So that's where we have some work.
Yeah, and the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, was that connected at all to this effort to sort of contain Chinese, I guess, economic tentacling throughout the globe, based on investments in fossil fuel based infrastructure?
We don't really know. We don't kind of know the counterfactual, as it were. We kind of don't know whether or not TPP would have succeeded in doing that. It probably would have succeeded in doing some things. I think that there, you know, was clear that the Clinton campaign was talking about some reforms to the TPP. So I don't know where it would have wound up, but I think that it would have at least laid the groundwork for a tighter economic union and lower barriers among those parties so that they could have accelerated the deployment of clean energy. And you could kind of see a version of that even outside the TPP, which I know less about because I wasn't involved in negotiating it, but the APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Coalition of Countries, had active tracks that were created by the U.S. and others to lower tariff barriers on environmental technologies, on wind turbines, on kind of everything, just to make things just cheaper and to make the markets work better. So the parties could have done that. Yeah, what some of the analysis is being done now, the World Resource Institute is doing some of this, should roll out in the next month or so, is kind of looking at what are the, if you look at Vietnam and the other sort of Southeastern Asian countries who've been very ambitious on tackling climate change, look at what their pledges were under Paris, look at what the investments are going in from China and just seeing the mismatch there and kind of hope that really you can make an appeal to the Chinese if they really do want to become the world's climate leaders, which is what the president, their president has announced, then to be consistent, you've got to look at this potential backpedaling that could happen through Belt and Road.
Right. So that's the big question there, I guess, is how sincere are their claims to be that global climate leader? So, all right, that was a great kind of panoramic for where we are and somewhat heartening. It's nice to hear some cautious optimism. We'll come back to this in more detail later,
sure.
But the overall mood, I think, globally and nationally right now is just such heavy pessimism. So I think this is a nice antidote, this kind of analysis. And we'll come back in more detail. Want to zoom out a little bit and give listeners a sense for your story, how you got into philosophy and then eventually policy work and so on. When people ask you, what do you do? How do you typically respond other than professor of philosophy?
Well, to tell you the truth, I mean, I would more likely describe myself first as a climate policy expert, someone who works mm-hmm. international climate policy as really my first line. And I think that over the last decade especially has become more my identity. I'll do that later if you'd like. Because I think that I would rather talk about the focus of my work than the discipline I come from. Mm-hmm. Insofar as the discipline that I come from, which I love, is one which is highly unusual for the work that I do. And I don't want it to be a hurdle for mm-hmm. people listening to me. I was pretty adamant that when I started really trying to make a deep dive and create an identity for myself in Washington on climate policy, that I didn't want to be, for example, a person who only worked on the ethics of climate change. Mm-hmm. Because even though I think you and I would agree that all of climate change is a gargantuan moral problem, through and through, every part of it, everything we talked about just in the last couple of minutes, right, has been loaded moral and normative questions all throughout that. Mm-hmm. But I think that if you go into a room somewhere in D.C. or, you know, the U.N. in New York or someplace else and sort of say, all right, let's have a comprehensive project on climate change, and then say, here's the ethical stuff, and it's just like one little corner over here. And you guys who claim you're ethicists, you can work on that. You know?
Yeah, after we've done all the real
after
work.
We've done all the real work, exactly. And so I think that's how I describe myself now, is I work in international climate policy, and then talk about, you know, how I got here later.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a common refrain that I hear from a number of the people that I interview. I've come to call it the Trojan horse strategy. You know, don't lead with the, you know, the title or identity marker of philosopher or ethicist. Just do good work.
Right.
Yeah.
And prove that you've got something to offer.
Yeah.
Right, which is independent. So, I mean, one of the things that I was able to offer that kind of happened unexpectedly for me was really becoming an expert on India climate and energy policy. And that's one of the things that led to my appointment mm-hmm. At the State Department. And I was the India lead for the Special Envoy for Climate Change. And it's, again, some of the hardest work I've ever done, but the best thing I've ever been able to contribute to.
Yeah.
And that came from just knowing my stuff about India. Now, I think that a lot of my skills that I picked up along the way from graduate school and my postdoc and stuff certainly helped me to be able to claim that expertise, but they were tools to get there. They weren't mm-hmm. actual substance.
Mm-hmm. So let's retrace the steps, as it were, for how you got to the place of being able to do the best thing that you've ever done, as you put it. Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in rural Georgia. Mm-hmm. I was born in Atlanta. My parents moved pretty soon after I was born, and I spent about half, the first half of my childhood in a place called Covington, Georgia, just east of Atlanta, mm-hmm. and a small town. And then from junior high through high school in a place called LaGrange, Georgia, which is southwest.
How would you describe your intellectual awakening? Was there a favorite book, a favorite teacher?
I always liked school. I liked books. I think that the awakening really was in high school when I joined the debate team. Mm-hmm. And I kind of stumbled onto it. And so I will certainly say that my most influential teacher in high school was my debate coach. His name was Earl Marsh. He was English teacher. And that's really where I mean, there's two things. On one hand is, you know, learning to love argumentation, right? Mm-hmm. Which is definitely what people who go into philosophy, you got to love one way or another. You
uh-huh.
know, there are softer and harder versions of it, but if you don't like disagreements and trying to come up with a better reason about something or a better argument, then I think that it's not the right discipline for you. And then I think the other thing was that I did policy debate, so it was really, really learning to love taking deep dives into policy issues and then try to figure this stuff out. And largely, though, you know, this is the thing. It's like, I think that most debate coaches are not real experts in the policy, especially at the high school level, are not experts in the particular policy arena that might be the topic for the year. There's like one topic chosen, NDT style or national debate tournament style policy debate, because it changed. Like, 1 year it's arms sales, and the next year it'll be, you know, judicial reform. So what you really are helping kids learn how to do is learn how to do independent research on a topic they know nothing about. And so that was definitely something there. And I guess I'd say the other, then there's people say, well, where'd the environment stuff come from? And that didn't really come from a person, frankly. It came from a place. So, I mean, one of the best things about growing up in the rural South was really just sort of the easy access to nature, which, you know, was sort of not pristine wilderness at all. When you're a kid, was sort of felt like it. So there was a little creek that sort of ran adjacent to my neighborhood in Covington that I just fell in love with, called Rock Creek. And I would go there, and I would just, and I was a kind of an awkward kid, a little socially awkward. And so if I was not kind of having on the outs with my friends, or even just if I just felt like it, I would spend most of my time after school there, just kind of playing and learning, kind of living in this little ecosystem. And you know, I had the great fortune of taking my own children there. And it's magical. And I think if there's anything that's sort of imprinted on me about the idea that the natural world is something to be cherished and enjoyed, but also needs to be protected.
That's a really powerful, visceral memory I can see that is charged with emotion. And that's one thing I wonder, how necessary is an experience like that for people to take a real concern in the environment and or climate issues? One problem that I often come up against is motivation, problem of how to motivate certain people around the climate problem. So I don't know, do you think that's a necessary condition for people to really prioritize and care about the environment?
Look, I don't think it's necessary, and I don't think it's sufficient, but I do think it helps an awful lot. And I mean, there's a really rich literature. Environmental psychology tries to, you know, assess how much it helps, and, you know, what are the sort of things that are more or less sorts of experiences that make one more or less amenable to having a certain kind of sense of environmental values. And that's propped up in my work over the years. Early part of my career was working way more on restoration ecology than I was working on climate change, which is just the practice of trying to recreate ecosystems that have become degraded over time. And I was really attracted of thinking about those opportunities, community gardens and other places where, in a very urban setting, you can still get some kind of, develop some different kinds of affinity towards nature, develop what I called at the time a sense of ecological citizenship. But I would never argue that it's necessary. I think you can get to these conclusions in many different ways. I edit a journal, Ethics, Policy, and Environment, which I've been editing for under different names for 20 years now. And if you pick up an actual physical, which is unusual for people to do these days, but pick up the actual physical hardcover, right, of the journal, and look at it, the front cover is actually a polluted urban setting. And Ben Hale and I, who's my co-editor, who's Ben is at the University of Colorado, we chose that picture as opposed to, you look at a lot of environmental journals, you know, it's sort of some picture of mountains or grasslands or a beautiful ocean or something like that. We picked that one because the focus is on, it has got as much beyond embracing and improving degraded areas of the world as much as it is on preserving the stuff that does, you know, draw you out and feel connected to the natural world. And there are so many people that I meet in climate circles and broader environmental circles who never had access to anything like the kind of ecosystems that I had access that I think are just
Well, exactly. I mean, those kind of urban environments, that's where most of the people live.
We better hope that you can become an environmentalist coming from an environment like that. Otherwise, our chances of success are pretty low.
Yeah. So I saw that you triple majored in political science, history, and philosophy, and that you also did grad work in political science when you were at UCLA while getting your PhD, coupled with this influential experience on the debate team. Was the idea of a dual career in academia and policy planted early on, or did that develop later?
It's interesting because I had this occasion, 13 or 14, to go back and give a talk at my undergraduate college. And I sort of was the dean who had invited me sort of asked me to kind of think about this, like how is your background here, right? How did it help you to do? And I just started the State Department then. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was not well-formed at all. The idea of having a dual career track wasn't well-formed at all. In fact, I think that I wound up in philosophy kind of in a very haphazard way. I had a political science and a history major kind of in train, you know, and almost completed by the time I was a junior. And then I went away to D.C. actually and did a summer internship at a U.S. Senate office. And I came back just incredibly charged up to return immediately. You know, go to law school or either go back to the Hill and then go to law school or go to law school and then go back to the Hill, like something like that. And then I kind of very, very abruptly my senior year decided I wanted to get a philosophy degree as well. Also study in a track, we had a great books track, and I kind of dove into that, which I had not done before.
Mm-hmm.
And stayed 5 years in college so that I could actually complete a third major in philosophy and this great books track, which got me interested in the classics. And then so I could be in a position to apply for grad school.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really weird. It was sort of like I sort of started in one path and I abruptly jumped to another one. And then it took me a long time to kind of figure out that I had these two great desires that had been developed in my formative years and I needed to integrate them somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a while to sort of figure out how to do that.
Yeah. And when you applied to grad school, was the plan to become a university professor?
Yeah. In fact, the plan was not only to become a university professor, but also to return to a liberal arts college setting to try to go back into that kind of teaching intensive, active everyday interaction with students in a way that kind of doesn't happen, sadly, I think, big research universities where I spent my career very often. But that was the idea, and then things just really did change, I think, as I sort of evolved and I began to sort of find the stuff that I was more passionate about overall that kind of began to integrate the interest in policy and politics and the interest in really, you know, logic and reasoning.
Mm-hmm. You had told me in the past about a 3-year postdoc you did in Alberta.
Yeah.
That was very formative for the direction that your career took. Can you tell us about that time and why it was so influential on your career?
Sure. And I think that was probably the most influential educational experience I've had in my career in a lot of ways because it was the most concentrated and the most coherent and it wasn't kind of flailing around like it's starting to do one thing and then shifting to another. So I had done a research assistantship with Carl Craner, some may know, who's a fantastic person in the philosophy department at UC Riverside and on environmental risk assessment. And Carl has written a number of incredibly influential books. The most recent one is called Legally Poisoned, which is about plastics. And just one of these people who rigorous academic philosophy work in the public policy realm.
Mm-hmm.
Carl had a position on a California board that was created by a proposition in California to look at what are the appropriate warning labels to put on toxic substances and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a small little crew of graduate students around him that had worked with him on that. And I didn't wind up doing my dissertation work on this at all. But I think that but it was that experience that got me interested because it was really the first way that I saw the ability to kind of really, for someone with a background such as ours, to really do a very, very deep dive into the technical issues of law and policy analysis, economics, mm-hmm. and then kind of put our own, add what we sort of bring to a conversation like that and produce something that can be absolutely respected
mm-hmm.
and taken as a serious input into a substance issue of public policy. I think that Carl, I would sort of compare his work most closely with someone like Christian Trader-Bruchette, did the same thing
mm-hmm.
on disposal of nuclear waste and a number of other issues. So that I did that, had experience, and I went off and my very first job was a 1-year job at Texas A&M University, and while I was there, I was trying to finish a dissertation, and through kind of happenstance, a friend named Eric Higgs, who's at the University of Victoria now, on the School of Environmental Studies, and at the time was in anthropology at the University of Alberta, told me about this opportunity to apply for a postdoc for a new research team that had been created in Canada on environmental risk assessment that's run by an environmental engineer, now retired, named Steve Baruti. And it was one of these things where it was a big government grant produced in Canada, set up a bunch of different chairs around the country, and there was a requirement for interdisciplinarity in the teams that were created by these. And
would this have been mid-90s, late-90s?
This would have been mid-90s, yeah.
Okay.
Basically, I, as happens when you're in one of these one-year jobs, you're kind of scrambling and looking for stuff. I was on the job market sort of selectively for philosophy, and I applied for this postdoc. And because of the experience I had with Carl Craner, I think primarily, and also just a little bit of tutoring from Paul Thompson, who was also at Texas A&M at the time, I was able to do very well, I think, in the interview there, and then got the offer to join this interdisciplinary team and then move to Edmonton. And it was great because, first of all, 3 years, no teaching, was fantastic. You know, I always told people the optimal career trajectory in the academy would be a postdoc like this and then emeritus, and like skip everything in between, because I didn't have to go to any committee meetings. I didn't have to supervise, you know, any graduate students. I could just really do hardcore research with this collection of scientists and social scientists I was around. And I was kind of, first I was really thrown into the deep end to really prove my utility to them. And a lot of what we were looking at was the tar sands in northern Alberta.
Okay.
And producing risk models from everything from assessment to management to communication on the oil sands or tar sands, favorite term. And way before people were thinking about the climatological impacts of those, but really just the more straightforward environmental impacts of production of oil from the tar sands.
And so, was this before production had really got going?
Production was just kind of beginning. It was like one of those things where the market forces weren't quite aligned yet to sort of reach a price point where this was really going to get into the market, but people started to invest in it, sort of looking for the day when that would happen. And there were kind of stops and starts there, but now it's obviously full blast. But we were kind of looking at the environmental impacts of that, looking at some other environmental issues as well up there, and kind of just general questions of how do you sort of create better, more productive risk assessment, risk management models. And it was great because it was proving my utility and also learning how these other sciences and social sciences work, learning how to read their literature and digest it and understand it and synthesize it and integrate it into a broader whole. And some of the tasks that, you know, I wound up doing during this period for Steve included things like, you know, editing a working paper series, so I had to really be able to understand, you know, the contributions from a vast array of disciplines into this, and then producing one giant report we called The Ideal World of Risk Management. Kind of went sort of, you know, issue by issue by issue and tried to come up with a comprehensive approach to this. And, you know, whether was successful or not, I don't know, but I think just the experience of it was great, and it was interdisciplinary in a way that I didn't even know that it would work this way. It wasn't just a bunch of humanists sitting around talking about the common text that was sort of making the rounds in, you know, philosophy and English, you know, in art history, but it was really much more difficult, true integration across these different
issues. So you've been doing interdisciplinary work for a long time, obviously, before it became sort of a buzzword.
Right.
And, I mean, some of what you said already explains why this work is hard, and a different kind of hard than the hard of, you know, academic philosophy. But beyond that, you know, familiarizing yourself with literatures from different disciplines, you know, digesting that, synthesizing that, are there other things that make the work hard that would not immediately come to mind? Or put another way, what are some of the wrong ways to do interdisciplinary work, in your view?
I don't have a really considered view on that. I guess more as I have experiences that I draw from that I think have worked. I don't really have like a theory of interdisciplinarity. I'm not sure that I could create a program that really worked. And the weird thing, though, but I'll say a couple of things. I mean, one is, you know, when I was an undergrad in the late 80s, even at a small liberal arts college, people were starting to really, you know, catch on to interdisciplinarity. This Great Books program that I was part of was sort of set up on the St. John's, you know, model.
Yeah.
You know, it was a sort of a model for interdisciplinarity, largely in the humanities, somewhat in the social sciences a little bit. And it was really about sort of getting people to kind of think, recognize the common roots of a lot of what we think of as the more formalized, you know, disciplines today. And I think that's a good place to start, although I think it has limitations because then people go, well, yes, Aristotle talked about biology, but it was all false, right?
So, yeah, who cares? You know, yeah.
Who cares, right? And so then, and I think that just doesn't do it justice when you start thinking about, you know, how these methodologies developed over thousands of years. I would sort of say that, you know, the clear way in which it should not be done is that the role, let's just sort of say, put it this way, is that the more methodologically focused disciplines stick in the methodology corner of the room, mm-hmm. and those who are kind of focused on the substance of the issue stick in their corner of the room, and then you kind of mush them together in some way. And what that winds up being, as a mentor of mine, Bernd Bagnus, used to say, is that it's like the role of philosophy in the sciences is to be the methodology police, you know? And that's basically it. And I think that's the old bad kind of first wave of like post-World War II philosophy of science. Nonetheless, I'll stick with it for now. Because what I think now you see, for example, in the best programs in philosophy of science is that, you know, Pittsburgh's and Indiana and sort of other places like that, is the people coming out of those programs just know their science not because they've been a spectator from the outside mm-hmm. in a casual way, because they've taken deep dives into this stuff. You know, many of them have at least a master's degree in the science that they're studying.
Right.
And I think that they, you know, they've worked in labs. They've actually produced the kind of work. And so they're not just kind of stuck in a corner observing, sort of adding some either, you know, methodological or normative or kind of, you know, logical tweak or sort of a post after the fact of some discovery, then providing some kind of explanation for how you got there. But really, they're not keeping up with the literature, you know, on a weekly basis as if they were full-time in a chemistry department or evolutionary biology department or cell biology department or a physics program or a, you know, a climatology program. They've had enough experience there that they can actually look at the science and kind of know whether or not they understand the right questions to ask of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sort of think of, that's just kind of one example of interdisciplinarity, but I think it's probably one of the better examples out there. And it's always the one that I've actually thought that environmental philosophers should follow. For us to be truly successful, we really need to understand. At first, for a long time, I thought it was just the science, some relevant science we were working on.
Can I guess what you're going to say?
Sure.
Economics?
Well, not just economics, but close. And so far as economics is I think owns the language of values and public policy,
yeah.
I was going to say the policy institutions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think that I did not set out when I moved from, you know, the academy to the policy world, especially specifically into climate policy, to make a contribution to the literature on climate ethics,
mm-hmm.
Because I think it's being done very well by many people, a lot of my former colleagues like Dale Jameson and NYU, Steve Gardner at the University of Washington. I didn't set out to do that. But if any of those folks who do that kind of work maybe have listened to me about, and among others, is you can't really talk about either the problem side or the solution side of something like climate change unless you understand the institutions that are really trying to work on this.
Yeah.
And if you don't kind of know that world, and I would argue if you haven't tried to make a contribution within it, even if you're not, you know, a negotiator for a country like I was, that it's very difficult to give an accurate assessment of where do we go from here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, if you're going to do this work well, you need to be at least familiar, if not have tried to really participate in everything from science to policy, of course, recognizing that people are going to have particular interest in things that they want to, issues they want to make a contribution to.
Yeah, well, it is a truly awesome and daunting undertaking. I suspect, especially with regard to climate, I suspect that's one reason many people shy away from it. I know in my own case, you know, I taught environmental ethics for a number of years and, you know, did some graduate work on environmental philosophy, broadly speaking, but I really was drawn to the climate issue and teaching courses on climate change. And when I sat down to sort of develop a strategy to learn what I need to learn, it was just humbling, and really spent the last 3 years learning about the science, about the economics, about the policy history. I mean, it's a challenge, but for me, it's so exciting because you get to learn so much, and, you know, striving for that synoptic view to synthesize all those different disciplines and bodies of knowledge. It's in some ways, there's something inherently philosophical about the problem.
Yeah.
It just seems so ripe for philosophical analysis and reflection, of course, coupled with, you know, deep dives and mastery, or at least competence in the related and important disciplines.
I think that's right. And I don't know if you've you know, encountered this, but I also find it heartening, frankly, that it's pretty easy to write a very pessimistic book or a very pessimistic article about climate change. You know, if you're a cloistered philosopher, right, sitting here and kind of know, all right, there's this sort of get the basic physics and the basic kind of modeling of where the world's going. And you can read the headlines in the newspaper as well as anyone, mm-hmm. you know, which is like climate journalism is fantastic right now. But it's really easy to then come away from that and kind of go, and there's this intrinsic moral question here, and no one cares, right? Because nothing's getting better. And the fact that nothing's getting better means that no one really appreciates the moral question here, and they're being morally irresponsible from doing that. And I think there's an awful lot of literature in climate ethics that kind of sounds like that to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I'm being naive about this or overly optimistic, Pollyannish, but I think that once you start taking a deep dive into the science and a deep dive in the policy institutions, you find out like how many people are working on this, how many opportunities there are on the solution side, and how much people really care. And, I mean, are there, of course, there's huge roadblocks in the way, and there's obstacles, and there's a lot of worries as we sort of, as our scientific understanding gets better and better and better. We're going to have a report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change coming out in just a couple months
mm-hmm.
on the possibility of stabilizing the temperature of the planet at 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is one of the goals of the Paris Agreement. The old goal was like stabilize at 2 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial level. We've already warmed the planet one. We're seeing abundant impacts right already. Could we stabilize at 1.5
mm-hmm.
to help those poor countries, especially small island states, who are the most vulnerable? The new science, the new modeling on that is going to be very difficult for people to take in terms of the challenges faced an ambitious target like that. But the fact is, it is an actual conversation that's happening. It's
mm-hmm.
not they're sitting on their hands and trying.
Mm-hmm.
And is this kind of pushback against Trump and kind of others on that? So I find it, for me, I find once you do actually make that, to learn the science, the economics, the policy, you realize you're part of a really, really, really big team.
Yeah. So I want to turn to some of your academic work, and then we can move into your transition into the policy world. So you've edited an astonishing number of anthologies.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you enjoy this work, or are you just a masochist?
I mean, I'll be as honest as I possibly can be about this, is that I used to love it. I used to really enjoy it a lot.
Uh-huh. I ask because I've heard editing volumes can be a nightmare.
Yeah.
I've never done it myself.
It can be, and I've had a couple that have been really difficult, although I really love the work that came out of them. I won't name them, because almost all of these are edited with one or another person, and so I don't want to cast aspersions on anyone. But I used to love it. I think I sort of, frankly, it gets harder and harder for me to do. And it's not really about not liking. I like working with people. I like the interaction with people. I think that just over time, it's just so hard really feel. And the hard part is I want to make sure that I do as responsible a job that I can on this. Every paper gets the attention that it deserves. And that I really sort of work with my authors as a community. And it's incredibly time-consuming. And that's why the couple projects that I'm working on now in that regard have slowed down in part because I just want to make sure that I have the time and I know that this cannot be the most frustrating, cannot be the easiest thing for others. But I think that probably my future will see less editing mm-hmm. of volumes. I do still love editing my journal, and I think that probably is where my editing energy and passion will kind of go, because I feel that it's really been built up into there's a real community around it now.
Mm-hmm.
There's a constituents. I think mm-hmm. that there's some really great people who are out there working on at the confluence of environmental ethics, environmental policy, and I think our journal has become a kind of a major, if not, I think the kind of the best outlet for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually
kind of breaking out of the insular academic journal world and reaching people who are actually working in policy?
I'm not exactly sure who it's reaching, but mm-hmm. I think that it's – I mean, I could know if I sort of looked into the stats on who's doing the downloads and traced all that, but I haven't done that yet. Mm-hmm. It's just that we're getting great papers from a dedicated group of people who will continue to do to be repeat offenders, right? Who continue to come back and continue to submit good work to us. And the other thing that I really like is that we adopted this model that I copied from the American Journal of Bioethics, which they may or may not have gotten from Behavioral and Brain Sciences, which I read a lot when I was in grad school, mm-hmm. of starting every issue with a target article, you know, and then having these peer refereed commentaries, mm-hmm. or these peer commentaries, so really short pieces that respond to it, and so that every issue, at least, you know, it's not as dynamic as something on the web, but at least it's like it's more conversational.
Yeah.
And I think that's where I kind of see that, you know, the number of people who just, you know, I'm not having to chase them down to do referee reports on an article, but who just want to comment on.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's a great model. I mean, I myself actually contributed one of the respondent reports for an article several years ago. And as a kind of, you know, up and coming, you know, just starting out scholar, it was good for me, you know, just kind of starting to wade into the world of environmental ethics and policy in a way that, you know, wasn't quite ready to do full blown, you know, publishing yet, but it was a good sort of on ramp to that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think that's right. That's right.
So let's turn to pragmatism. Can you give, you're probably most well known for your work in environmental pragmatism. Can you give listeners a quick primer on pragmatism? And tell us why it's a helpful approach for making sense of environmental issues.
So it's a great question. It's an appropriate question. So the unfortunate thing about me, and I think everyone in the pragmatism world knows this, is that I'm really not trained at all on pragmatism. And I couldn't give you a primer on pragmatism. It's sort of sad. So, but I would sort of argue that largely studied analytic philosophy in grad school, there was no courses. I mean, I never took a Dewey course or a James course or a Peirce course or any of the historical pragmatists. The closest I got was there's a wonderful guy at Riverside, David Glidden, who put some Rorty into a couple seminars I took with him, and I had another professor as an undergrad, Peter Brown, at Mercer, who also kind of early introduced me to Rorty. And Rorty's kind of, you know, I mean, bless his dearly departed soul, but I think the pragmatist world, you know, works. The people who do historical pragmatism really didn't like Rorty at all. Mm-hmm. A lot of philosophers didn't like Rorty at all and continue not to. But I think it was probably, that was my earliest introduction to someone who was writing about Dewey. My sort of pragmatism is a real small p pragmatism, although I've tried to make a space for the more orthodox historical pragmatism. Mm-hmm. And so, my early work to offer pragmatism as what I was calling environmental pragmatism as a way to set aside some of the entrenched debates in value theory that environmental ethics was embroiled in when I mm-hmm. got into the field as a graduate student, and mostly the debates over non-anthropocentrism versus some version of anthropocentrism, which people still work on today. And for people who haven't followed this, the old sort of analysis still out there, but passing, thankfully, was one of the contributions that philosophers could make to environmental problems was, first of all, to sort of make the argument that the reason that we have a lot of the environmental problems that we have today was because most ethical theories were human-centered, so anthropocentric.
Right.
Only saw that that humans were the kinds of things which were the proper object of direct moral consideration. And so the contribution that philosophers were supposed to make was to defend some version of non-anthropocentrism, non-human-centered ethics, to claim that there was room ethical analysis and moral theory to claim that there are that non-human entities, be they individual animals or species or ecosystems, could be the proper objects of moral consideration. Largely, again, originally a lot of this was because they had some or another version of intrinsic value. And you know, and then they were sort of the world was off and running, and I mean the most successful and most interesting versions of this are the sort of animal liberation, animal rights schools of thought, Peter Singer and Tom Reagan and everything that was built after, you know, Bentham, or began to at least gesture towards the idea that that there's no room for being a speciesist when it came to classical utilitarianism. Why is it that human pain matters but non-human pain doesn't? Singer really obviously develops that work to its fruition, and then there's a lot of wonderful work that comes out of that. And then I think there's on the other side there are the Holmes Wolstons and Baird Kallikaks of the world, and kind of of others who sort of argue that, make a similar kind of argument for very different reasons to ecosystems and whole species, that they also have some kind of value that needs to be defended.
Right.
Now, when I was sort of in the early 90s, Brian Norton came along and was one of the first, along with Anthony Weston, to sort of say, and I think it, Norton's was more methodological, I would argue. So Norton sort of said, why is this non-anthropocentrism stuff, theories in environmental ethics, he just didn't buy the proposition that the only way that you could defend the argument or come up with a workable and influential claim for why non-entities had to be respected against development, that you could do this through some, you didn't need to appeal to non-anthropocentrism to do that. You could do through some other more benign anthropocentric argument.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony Weston was a figure who was the first, I think, really to apply, like James and Dewey, to literature and environmental ethics. My contribution was come along and sort of take figures like that, add what I was kind of doing, which was more on a field called political ecology, and then kind of shape it and sort of say, this is environmental pragmatism. And environmental pragmatism is really two things. On the one hand, it's stuff like what Weston was doing, which was historical environmental pragmatism, taking the work of Dewey and James and the other canonical pragmatists and applying it to environmental problems. And I'm friendly with all those people, but I don't do that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other, half of it I've come to call methodological environmental pragmatism, which is just a series of arguments that say we don't even have to have these debates whether or not non-anthropocentric theories are the only true way
right.
of describing the value of nature. And that was, I think, where Brian Norton started. I think he evolved into a much more historically based kind of a claim. And I think then that's kind of where the terrain is. So really, kind of my version of environmental pragmatism is more simply, just simply, there are shortcuts through some of the theoretical debates. We don't need to finish those theoretical debates that used to dominate the literature of environmental ethics in order to make a claim that there's a moral issue at stake at the heart of environmental problems that needs analysis and that needs resolution. And it's okay to make a claim that sort of say morally respectable economic theory is going to give you the best tools, right, to engage in a policy debate over a better outcome, as opposed to some philosophical theory about the value of non-humans that many people will never come to embrace.
Right. Yeah. And from the political standpoint, you know, if you're just sticking with the non-anthropocentric intrinsic value of nature approach, you've lost most of the people.
You've lost most people
immediately.
If it wasn't for scarcity and problems like the time dependence, right, of climate change and other big issues that we look at today, you could afford to have that millennial conversation,
mm-hmm.
you know, about maybe we should all be non-anthropocentrists, but we can't afford that. You know, and Holmes Rolston, who's one of the founders of the field, has told me, of course, he goes, he testified to the Colorado State Legislature, he would sort of make the arguments that would most appeal to the people in the room.
Right.
And I said, right, so why don't we turn that into a rigorous process for figuring
yes.
out what arguments you would make, mm-hmm. rather than saying you would make the arguments that would appeal to them. And that's kind of like what I'm doing. So if anything, I think the best way to understand my version of environmental pragmatism is it's a very robust version of moral pluralism
mm-hmm.
applied to environmental issues specifically.
Yeah. That's really helpful, and this is definitely where my own thinking about this has gone over the last couple of years, you know, teaching this stuff, you know, following it in the news, what's happening politically and with the policy process, and, you know, reading about it in various literatures. And it strikes me that, I'd be curious to get your response to this, it strikes me that the social sciences, you know, engaging work that's been done in psychology, political science, about how, you know, people's different worldviews and value systems affect the way they perceive environmental issues and climate in particular, and then how do you craft or frame the problems and solutions in ways that morally resonate with those various different worldviews? Because it just seems like there's so much rich research coming out in that vein. And
yeah.
it seems like really good fodder for philosophers and ethicists to digest if they're hoping to make arguments that are going to be persuasive to various constituencies.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I think that set of literatures and that kind of research that you're pointing to there would really just be a way of kind of taking, really kind of doing something that bioethicists have been doing for decades. You know, mm-hmm. One of my best friends is Jonathan Marino, who's at the University of Pennsylvania, and, you know, a pragmatist in bioethics. But I mean, I think Jonathan is a pragmatist in bioethics, like I've been a pragmatist in environmental ethics. He's not like a doctrinaire, I'm going to come in and explain Dewey to you, and then kind of figure out, like, what do we do with this? There's a anthology that Glenn McGee edited years ago, I think, two editions called Pragmatist Bioethics, and Jonathan's got an article in there called Clinical Bioethics. It was always enormously influential to me, where he sort of says, look, I mean, when you're a clinical bioethicist, when you're actually working in a hospital environment, not just kind of working on the stuff abstractly, there is no room for monism. There's no room for anything other than pluralism of a very engaged sort, where you're actually learning, like, what is valued by the individuals that you're talking to and helping them to make these critical decisions about their loved ones or themselves. Well, the challenge for something like the environment, do a kind of a version of that clinical bioethics, requires exactly the tools that you're pointing to, right? Mm-hmm. It requires the broader work that's been done on why people value what they do and the statistical survey work that's been done on this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's been enormously helpful for me in winding up at George Mason University, is that I'm on the same campus with, I'd argue, one of the best environmental communications experts in the country, Ed Maybach. And Ed runs with Tony Leiserwitz at Yale something called the Climate Change in the American Mind Project.
Oh, yeah. This is great. Students love this, too.
The George Mason University Yale surveys, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're incredible because those are the questions that they're asking. They're looking at the American public, you know, in a very granular way. It's longitudinal. They've been doing this for over 10 years, mm-hmm. tracking their attitudes on every conceivable aspect of climate change, from whether you believe in it to what's your view on, you know, the agreements among scientists to, you know, carbon pricing, clean energy decisions, and all this kind of stuff. And then overlaying on top of it, like, what's the reasons why people are more attracted to one thing or another? That is the raw material that I think that we can use for shaping more morally responsible environmental policies. And not only shaping the policies, but getting support for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the clinical bioethicist has to do, right? Not just shape the option for the patient or the patient's loved ones, but help to work with them to get to a better decision.
This so-called six climate change Americas. And I actually think that this is one reason that I think President Obama found an effective way to message the climate issue, because he wouldn't just talk about future generations and the planet. He would talk about, you know, clean jobs and public health, and so on. You know, talking about interests that, you know, more people have than just environmentalists, was one reason I think he was able to do a lot of the things that he did.
That's how it should be, right? I mean, I've always sort of said, look, dealing with climate change is a gargantuan collective action problem. You know, we're all doing things that actually are, for the most part, promoting individual welfare, even societal welfare. But all collectively, we're doing something which is going to degrade our overall welfare. We just, most people kind of can't connect the dots there, or there are hurdles thrown up to blind them to connecting the dots. But at the end of the day, you better hope it's not the case that every time someone turns on a light switch, you know, they know that they're getting their energy from a non-polluting source. That's too much to ask. We would never get to us if that was what was required. We would never get to a solution. You need a bunch of people to understand that and to be pushing for policies. So that's the case that when you turn on your light switch, it just happens to be the case that, as where you're sitting now in Massachusetts, you know, it is part of a cap and trade program. Mm-hmm. Electricity is coming from a system which is part of a cap and trade program, which is designed to over time lower those emissions and then take the proceeds from trading emissions among firms to create bigger investments in renewable energy and renewable technology, which employs more people to do this, which just feeds, right, this virtuous cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, people who are turning on the lights don't need to know that. They just need to not stand in the way and not actively fight the policies that ultimately are going to serve both their near-term and their long-term.
So I have a few questions about what I would call turning the aircraft carrier of the profession of philosophy. So first, with young people and students just starting out, do you have advice for young people interested in getting involved in environmental issues. And related to that, do you have advice for young philosophers who are interested in environmental ethics? What can the next generation of environmental philosophers do better?
We're living in the midst of this renaissance on environmental issues, which is just astonishing. I mean, there are more opportunities now, from activism to work in policy today, to engage in environmental issues. It's tremendous. And it's everything from, you know, organizations like 350.org, which my friend Bill McKibben, you know, started with students at Middlebury some time ago, to the wealth of careers that are now available for people who work in the environment. In fact, as another friend of mine, Joe Rome, edits the blog, or used to be the editor of the blog Climate Progress, but still blogs for them. Joe puts it in one talk I've heard him give, is that, you know, when the world really is fully engaged on dealing with this problem, which we will have to do one way or the other. Like, there is no choice.
It's inevitable, yeah.
It's just absolutely inevitable. The question is, how soon do we do it? And do we do it in such a way and with enough ambition that we can prevent the worst consequences, which we can foresee now. And so once that happens, just about everything that people do will, in one way or another, will be involved in the, for lack of a better term, the global solutions economy. Mm-hmm. So if you're selling real estate, right, you're going to be attending to sea level rise, right? And you're going to have to be following very, very closely the sort of the regulations that are going to make it possible for people to, again, not put themselves in harm's way from future climate impacts. Manufacturing, energy, obviously, are sort of sectors like that. But across the board, everyone's going to be kind of engaged in this. If you want to get a flavor of one example of this, if you want to get a flavor of just the array of things that people are doing right now, specifically labeled climate something or other, the best thing to do is like to go to something like the one of these UN climate summit meetings, because it's not just the active negotiator sitting at tables, or, you know, as I was, you know, in closeted rooms and bilateral negotiations with the Chinese or the Indians or some other big party, but every group that's doing something on the issue has a booth there, right? And so it's this bazaar, in a good sense, of all of these career paths and opportunities in forestry, energy, in efficiency, in dealing with displaced persons because of climate change, you know, in climate and public health. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on, building materials and everything. You kind of see all these organizations that are arrayed out there, and they stand for, you know, the thousands in the hall stand for tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands, you know, hundreds of thousands outside who are doing kind of similar work. Mm-hmm. So my advice, like, to young people who are getting into this, frankly, is you might have gotten interested in environmental issues through a class you took in economics, or in political science, or in, you know, something else. But at the end of the day, you need to sort of figure out what is the passion that will keep you involved in it and keep you waking up excited about going to work every day and not depressed about it. And so I'm a huge believer in internships. If I have students in an environmental ethics class that I'm teaching who get interested in climate change, and then they go, oh, this is really great. Maybe should I go to grad school in philosophy too? Work on this? Like, no. What you need to do is like figure out first, what is it that you like about this? So you're near DC, get to an internship, right?
Yeah.
Go turn with a think tank like CAP or WRI or NRDC or, you know, someplace else, or a smaller outfit to sort of see what is it that grabs you about this stuff? And it could be that maybe it's the law. You know, maybe it is statistical analysis. It could be anything.
The first rule of grad school is you don't go to grad school to riff on the Fight Club rules. If you've seen that movie,
and you don't have to rush into it.
Right.
But realize that you don't have to rush into it. You know, I mean, I think my biggest mistake, I will sort of say, because, you know, like you said, you can look back. You can go read my transcript as an undergrad. You can kind of see the combination of things I'm doing now. I didn't see it as an undergrad, you know, at all. And I was just in this rush to, like, get into a PhD program. And I didn't take any time off between undergrad and grad school. And I've regretted it ever since. Mm-hmm. Because it was – I might have still wound up doing it. But I think the point is that I would have come to grad school with a better sense of what I wanted to accomplish if I'd taken some time.
Yeah. It just strikes me, too, that maybe that would be something that would be healthy for the profession. You know, I mean, let's say if graduate programs had maybe not one of the requirements, but would encourage applicants to have some practical experience in an internship or working in a different sector that might be related to the research that they would do for their dissertation, so that we would be producing more PhDs who had more of an, whether it's an interdisciplinary or more of a sort of practitioner mentality. They more know how to embed in a certain sector or a different, you know, conceptual ecosystem, and then, you know, use the tools that we train, we develop in studying philosophy in order to make a valuable contribution in that area.
I think that's totally right. And I think that, you know, I mean, there are departments out there that are getting very serious about publicly engaged philosophy and stuff that we used to only call applied philosophy. But I think that to really be serious, and some of these are, you know, very traditional programs who are just starting to kind of see that they're getting more, there's more interesting work to be done outside the academy, or not more than in the academy. I mean, there is also interesting work to be done outside the academy. And I think if they really are serious about that, they need to provide support and incentives for students who are interested in these kinds of issues to go do summer internships as well, to do practicums in other departments where they're really kind of learning this kind of stuff. And that's every time I get asked to give a talk about, you know, how did you get where you got, how did other people get there, like I say that's one of the things that, you know, I kind of got through my research assistantship with Carl Craner. You know, it was just luck of the draw, frankly, that I was in a department where someone was taking that kind of role in a substantive debate over public policy.
Yeah. I mean, when you came to BC, so for listeners, I had Andrew, I invited Andrew to come to Boston College to talk to my own students in my climate change class, as well as the university generally, about his work. And I have to confess, I was embarrassed when no one but myself and one grad student attended a brown bag lunch talk that he was giving on public scholarship. And I was embarrassed, but I was also just disappointed because I was like, Andrew Light, like, I think you play the role for many people that Carl Craner played for you as a, you know, an exemplar for what else we could do of value. But I saw it as a symptom of the very problem that you were there to discuss, you know, that where were the professors? Where were the other graduate students? It seemed that there was not sufficient interest, in my view. And of course, people are busy and so on. There could be other factors. How receptive or resistant have you found departments to be to this message?
Well, I mean, I think that it's somewhat self-selected in that I think that the people who asked me to speak are the ones who are interested in the topic. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I gave a talk like late last year, early this year at UC San Diego, which is a great, fantastic department.
So yeah.
Incredibly distinguished history, but also if you kind of look at the work of the Kitchers and the Churchlands and kind of others who have sort of been there over time, especially in philosophy of science, always kind of engaged with other disciplines as well. So it kind of makes sense that in more traditional philosophy settings, it's going to come from, I think, programs like that.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like this. And then there are obviously, you know, the Michigan States and, you know, many others who are moving forward and really actively encouraging students to develop interests outside the academy, but it's haphazard. I think there was probably a moment where I felt like I wanted to try to turn the, you know, the aircraft carrier, the discipline, if it's that big, in this direction, and I don't feel that anymore, frankly, because on one hand I value a lot of very traditional academic work in our field, and I would never say that it's not valuable. It's past its time, and it's whatever. I wouldn't say that at all. It's just not what I choose to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that, on the other hand, I sort of think that people with our kind of training have an enormous amount to offer in these areas of public policy, and there's a great need because, you know, the language of values, as I put it earlier, public policy is kind of owned by economists right now.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more to what's important and normatively important and represents value, both individual and collective, and good public policy that can be captured in even the astonishing array of very different economic theories that are being used in those circles, as opposed to, you know, even 20 years ago. So I think that your other part of your question was on young professors and environmental philosophy, and I would sort of say, just repeat what I said before, is first of all, you really need to know the area. Pick an area, restoration ecology or conservation biology or climate change or something like that. If you want to get involved in the policy realm, you need to understand the science, become conversant in science, become conversant in the institutions that the science and the values and everything else are trying to influence.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you're there, then you need to decide, like, what's the level of involvement you want to have? Do you want to do something like what I did, which is create an identity as a policy expert for yourself that's so independent that, in fact, it could be the kind of thing that gets you a full-blown position in the policy? Or is it, or do you want to sort of have a continue, sort of, you know, stay primarily as an academic, but still be able to participate in these processes? And once you kind of figure out what you want to do, then I think it's just a slow and steady commitment of work over time.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully you'll be in a department that recognizes this publicly engaged work, which is not just producing academic articles as valuable and as something that needs to be rewarded for promotion or tenure or renewal of your contract.
Mm-hmm.
But you might not, and that's part of the decision you've got to make.
Right.
Is that if it's not rewarded, you still stick with it because you think it is a contribution you want to make, which is a difficult thing for many people to find the time to do.
Sure.
But I would argue it's totally worth it once you begin to find an independent voice. There are, again, thousands and thousands of organizations out there who are looking for non-resident fellows, non-resident scholars, people from, even if you don't live in the city where those places are, where you can contribute now, creating a substantive policy report or blogging on their site or something like that. Those opportunities are there, and the economists and the political scientists and the scientists, and like, they're all taking advantage of that. We're the ones who just haven't been taught or haven't been pointed in that direction, because that's just not where our discipline has been valuing the world.
Exactly. That's a lot of what my new mission is.
Yeah.
To create the pointers, to light the pathways, so to speak. You mentioned blogging. The first time I saw you speak in public was at the APA in D.C.
Yeah.
It was a panel you'd organized around philosophy and blogging that featured Matt Iglesias, David Roberts, and my favorite blogger at the time, now retired somewhat, Andrew Sullivan. How do you think blogging fits into the portfolio of public philosophy practices?
Well, I just think it's now become this medium that, on the one hand, it's a low barrier for entry, and it's no longer the case that to communicate a public message, you are no longer at the mercy of the gatekeepers of the editorial page of the New York Times, the Washington Post, right?
Yeah. The failing New York Times.
Oh, well, and I think all those are great, and I think that everyone should still aspire to place in places like that. And outlets have been even created, like The Stone, which is wonderful.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, I think the great thing about blogging is it does allow for this combinations of mediums, short form and longer form journalism, and this ability, this affinity, especially if you do it regularly, which you need to do in order to get people to pay attention to it, if you don't have a platform, right, that already has way of getting a follow. You got to do it regularly. You got to do it often. And what I think came out of that panel, I hope, and I think it's still archived somewhere, you watched that really great session that we put together, is that all three of those guys had some kind of background in philosophy. Matt Iglesias was an undergrad philosophy major at Harvard. Dave Roberts did a master's degree in philosophy at University of Montana, started a PhD at the University of Alberta, but then decided to do what he's doing now, which is fantastic. And I'm so glad Dave Roberts did not become like a academic somewhere, because he's doing so much more good for the climate cause, given his perch now at Fox, before that exists. And then Andrew Sullivan, who did a PhD at the Kennedy School of Political Philosophy.
Right.
And what I think comes out of that is that there's something about, again, you've put it very many good ways along our conversation, that really good, rigorous philosophical training from a variety of approaches gives you the ability to read a lot of stuff, understand it deeply, synthesize it, understand what's a good reason and a bad reason, right? And then turn it around into a product that you can then communicate to the broader world. That's a skill that we have that I think is extremely valuable, and in and of itself is a good reason to try to do this stuff.
So that wraps the first part of my conversation with Andrew. Be sure to check out part 2. I'll be posting in a few days. where Andrew will lay out really the blueprint for how he did it, how he moved out of the academy and, you know, went on to develop a successful parallel career and really make a great social and political impact. Music for today's episode provided by Xperia. Thanks again to the APA for their support through the Barry Fund for Public Philosophy, and to you for checking out the podcast. Pro tip, if you're interested in careers in government, in business, in education, and so on, if you go onto my website, you'll find the podcasts categorized according to field or industry. So, and I'll be updating that regularly. And again, if you are enjoying the podcast, best thing you do is share it with a few friends or rate and review it on iTunes. Thanks again for listening, and I hope to see you next week.